From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview that our guest host, Kim McQueen, conducted with local author, Cince Bonino, whose new book is One Key See, One Key Do, published by Onion River Press. This week, Kim prefaced the interview with some helpful information, so I'll turn it over to her recorded introduction. I hope you enjoy her interview with Cince Bonino.
One Key See, One Key Do explains how to improve your ability to be creative in useful and productive ways. Discover how to be creative on purpose, not just through happy accidents or in mysterious eureka moments. One Key See, One Key Do presents learning principles, creative methods, and tips for being intentionally aware that can help unlock your creative potential and let loose your creative genius. Learn how to sift through creative ideas and choices in a faster and more conceptually focused way, whether you're a student, a teacher, a stay-at-home parent, a creative, business, or scientific professional. The book's foreword is written by Marty Cooper, who's widely regarded as the father of the cell phone. Cooper writes, "One Key See, One Key Do is in itself a masterpiece of creativity. Whether you are learning to be more creative or teaching others, reading this fine book will open doors you never knew existed." Cince Bonino is a former professor of creativity and conceptual development with a background in education and the psychology and mechanics of human learning. Cince does one-on-one awareness sessions in person and online to help individuals better define and create the way they want to be in the world. She also presents and leads workshops on creativity, problem solving, communication, teaching and learning, and personal awareness. She's the author of The Ride of Your Life, Choosing What Drives You, and Relationship Residue. She's also the creator of Wise Asks cards. That's the non-tarot tarot deck. Cince lives in Burlington, Vermont with her cats Jasper and Melina and enjoys the time she gets to spend with her son, who currently serves in the U.S. Army. I interviewed Cince just after the launch of One Key See, One Key Do at Phoenix Books here in Vermont. We talked at the Karma Birdhouse in Burlington, and you might be able to hear some evidence of that during our talk. The Karma Birdhouse is a co-working space filled with interesting creative people, some of whom were walking by on creaky old wooden floors while we talked. I hope you enjoy my interview with Cince. I want to start out by asking you why this book now. I'm taking a cue from your dedication of the book to your students, where you say thank you to the students who allowed you to crawl around inside their brains.
Yes.
Tell me about that experience and how it led to this book.
So the students in my creativity class, which I taught at the college level for not quite 15 years, they came into my classroom often really wanting to learn to be more creative, other times thinking they already were creative and not trusting somebody of a certain age to teach them to be creative, or scared that nothing could help them to be creative. But in order for it to work, they had to be willing to let me crawl around inside their brains, meaning they had to be vulnerable. They had to become aware of what they were doing so they could show me what they were doing so I could help them. And when I say what they were doing, I mean their thought process, their creative process, and the whole emotional, cultural, psychological megillah that surrounds all of that and is threaded through it. So doing that is a very, very, as I said, vulnerable place to be. So there was a willingness on their part. I taught creative nonfiction for a while, and the same thing was true there. If somebody wrote a really good piece of creative nonfiction, they were first crawling around inside their own brain, but then putting that down on the paper for me to see.
Yeah.
So they invited me in to see, and boy, do you get close.
Yeah.
So that's what the book's about, that can you do that for yourself?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love how it's organized into exercises and prompts that are sort of doled out in smaller bits throughout the book. And it begins with learning how to see. Can you talk a little bit about how you taught your students to learn to see?
Yes. So there's a lot we miss. There's a lot we don't notice. I think everybody who's a writer, when they notice things, they remember them. They see them in different ways. They think, oh, I could use that, or, oh, that's fascinating. But there's still a lot that we miss. And the students who took my class were from all different kinds of majors, most of them creative majors, but not all. So one of the first exercises we did in the class was to walk around and look down. The first prompt that I ever give my students in my class used to be looking down. And some of the students would think of it as literally looking down, which was great, but it didn't have to be literally looking down. It could also be, oh, I'm looking down on that from a very high height, or I'm looking down on someone because I don't like the way they're dressed, or that person was mean to that person, that sort of thing. So I asked them first to see more in their definition of what those words meant to them, mm-hmm. looking down. And then to literally see more about looking down, whether they were visually, I asked them to walk back to their dorm a different way than they normally did, or to their apartment or wherever, and to look down and notice something that they might not normally see because they're not always looking down. I told them how when I first learned to drive, that the first time I had driven somewhere where I parked and then went, oh my God, I don't remember how I got here. I had no memory of the last part of the journey, yeah. turning on the block. And I assumed it meant that I had killed someone and blanked it out. That yeah. why would I not remember? And I didn't understand at that point in my life how your brain takes over for you. So as you're walking around, you're not necessarily even looking where your feet go. Right. As you get older, this becomes more important. But, right. When you're younger, no. So to purposely look, I asked them to do that. So it's to see more, not only by noticing more of what's there, but looking in places you haven't looked before or you've looked over. Whether you're looking up and, oh, I never noticed there was something up there on top of the shelf that I hadn't seen in this particular place. I go all the time. But I also want to notice what was a conversation I had about that particular topic in the past with someone. Say I'm just thinking about the color red. The color red. What does red mean to me? Oh, God, I remember those shoes, those little sandals I had when I was a kid, and they were red. So I'm seeing something because I'm looking in a place that I want, maybe wouldn't normally look into.
Right. You write in the book about giving this exercise not just to students, but it's in One Key See, One Key Do as something the reader can do in the moment as they're reading, looking down at the floor, and then making note in a journal of the thoughts that come to you when you're just immersed in the act of looking at the floor, right? And not moving away from that attendance to the moment to whatever focus you're expected to do in that moment, right? You don't have yes. to stop and go read your email or give somebody a call.
Yes. Permission
to clean something.
Yes. Permission to keep going and to feel maybe weird while you're doing it. Why am I doing this? I feel ridiculous, which is another important thing right. for being creative. So I'm looking, and then to continue to not limit my looking. I'm looking, I'm noticing things. I'm also noticing what I feel about those things. Right. Why did I ever buy that pillow for my couch? It's ugly. If I right. see that, and that's what I'm thinking, that's part of what I'm noticing.
Right.
So not labeling, I'm only going to notice this.
Right.
Noticing everything, noticing what you're noticing, notice how you're noticing it, and continuing to just go, giving yourself permission to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so important for college students to expose themselves to that way of thinking. And I guess, I mean, it's important for everyone. It's important for me as a professional to read those words and give myself permission to not go and do some task that people have been waiting for me to do for a couple of weeks. It's just to sit in the moment and keep noticing.
The task is considered worthy. The looking we label as not worthy. It's frivolous.
Right.
But it's not.
Something kids do.
Right. It's something, it's part of thinking. And noticing more helps you to be in the moment and choose more wisely, as in choose what fits what you're trying to do, whatever that might be.
Right.
Right.
Or are expected to do.
Yes. And we are encouraged to hurry, hurry, and get done.
Yeah.
So getting it done is what we're trying to accomplish, but we haven't really honored the process. We haven't figured out what we want fully because we're so busy grabbing something. We do almost everything in life as if we have four small wailing children in tow, forcing us to move forward. You know, quickly, get them in the car, do this, do that, do this. Oh my God, I survived.
Yeah.
We take the joy out of what we're doing a lot too by doing that, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So one key C.
Yes.
The next key is do.
Yes.
And the key between those two is vulnerability.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me more about that?
So I have to see more, but then I have to choose what I'm going to do after I see. And my reason for doing is where I have the opportunity for being vulnerable. If I'm open to creating something, putting something together, whether it's with colors or food or words to craft a sentence or a story, whatever it happens to be, because I'm expressing, I'm creating. I have to be vulnerable to do that. I have to step away from letting how it will be judged or what people will think about it in terms of whether or not it's valuable or correct or enticing or any word you want to come up with. I have to let that go. I have to understand that if I'm open to noticing everything, there are probably going to be feelings that come with that.
Yeah.
And to not hide from all those feelings, not hiding from the fear, not hiding from the hope, but using that to explore further, to explore more, to see more, so that then I can figure out, what do I want to use? How do I want to connect it? What am I seeing? Am I grasping the first thing that's shiny because I just want it to be over? We're back to, let's just finish this. No, let's bring this into the world. Let's create it.
So how did students respond when you first started doing this work with them?
So there are a lot, similar to a lot of the prompts in the book, there are a lot of things that students are asked to do that help them to be vulnerable. One of the things I would ask my students to do would be to sing, I don't know if you know this song, There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So I say, okay, everybody, come on, let's get in a big circle. And they're like, what's she doing now? So I get in the circle and I start to sing, There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly. And if they don't know the song, I teach it to them.
Uh-huh.
And I say, we're going to sing this out loud. And some of them are quite, no, really. We're going to sing this out loud. So we sing it, and it's so repetitive. And it's nonsense, but it's logical nonsense.
Yeah.
There's a rhyme and a reason to it, literally.
It's a narrative.
Yeah. And so they start to laugh. The ones who are not familiar with it laugh the hardest. The others laugh also because they remember it from when they were children. Most of them had a picture book of the story when they were small. They remember that, the ones who know the song. And then I ask them to rewrite the song and to come up with something that has a similar structure, something that's funny. As in being willing to be ridiculous is really, really important when you're being creative. And it's important because without that conscious choice to allow yourself to appear other than perfect, you will begin to edit yourself before you have something to edit.
Right.
That's the way I would say it.
Yeah, and you can see why this would initially put people, writers especially, on edge, because when you're in school, you have assignments, to complete.
Right.
And you have deadlines, and you may have six instructors who don't know each other's deadlines that they've all given you, and you have to be creative. It feels like you have to be creative in six different ways on any given day. And so you're really aware of the time crunch. So it seems so important to learn how to be vulnerable and ridiculous in that space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Whenever you have a time crunch, our response is usually, let's get down to business.
Yeah.
Now. Let's get this done.
Yeah.
So logically, what do I need here? I'm going to move forward. I'm going to do this. I need that. You try to, it's almost like building a bad building. You're cutting corners
yeah.
as you start,
yeah.
right? I'm using the most economic materials that I can.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's something I've used in the past. I'll dust that off and I'll use that again.
Yeah.
And you just keep going that way. You're not trying to produce something that's not as good as it could be.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously,
right.
that's not your goal. You're trying to not fail by not having something, right?
Mm-hmm.
The something that you have already decided that you need.
Right, to bring to the marketplace or to your professor.
Yes, and instead of uncovering it, instead of bringing it into being, instead of creating it, you're forcing it.
Mm-hmm.
You're forcing it forward to, well, I'll take this, I'll take that, I'll put that, and I'll put it together.
Mm-hmm.
And it may even, on paper, tick off all the boxes
mm-hmm.
of what it's supposed to do. But it's not fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
It's not amazing. And it might not even be you.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you thought you needed to do to complete the assignment in a way that satisfied, which is a very important word in the sentence,
yeah.
that satisfied the requirements. So, satisfied. You know, I mean, it's, you can say, I'm satisfied, and that sounds great. But if you say that was satisfactory, suddenly it's not so great.
Well, it's not, it doesn't feel creative.
No.
Yeah.
No.
It doesn't feel like art.
And satisfactory doesn't necessarily get you another reader or someone who wants to come back and read that, your work, the next time.
Right, it's like a C.
Yeah, it is.
It's like a C.
It's like getting a C. Okay, there was no disaster. We have averted disaster.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Was that really your goal?
Right.
And that's important because we go through life and we've kind of been acculturated to do that, to attempt to avoid disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about delicious, right?
Yeah. Well, you write really well about this, and in the part of the book about ridiculousness and vulnerability. So I'd like to ask you to read to us from that part of the book right now.
Sure. So the first Dookie principle is just what we're talking about. Be willing to appear ridiculous. This is difficult for many of us. We worry about losing our credibility. We are concerned people might judge us poorly or fail to take us seriously if we put forward an idea they regard as silly or not worth considering. We also care deeply about how we see ourselves. We don't want our inner self to feel ashamed or to harbor regrets. These are all legitimate concerns. Being authentic can be risky. How do we find the courage to suggest ideas or solutions we fear others might initially misjudge or ultimately ridicule? We need to care more about bringing an idea we believe could turn out to be uniquely excellent to everyone's attention than we care about avoiding any potential ridicule or judgment that could come our way. If we overfeed our fear of being judged, it may cripple our creativity by convincing us to avoid anything that seems risky, no matter how inventive or excellent it may be. If you don't take risks, you'll never unlock your true potential. Not during your work on a specific creative project and not in your overall creative practice. You can improve your creativity without being willing to appear ridiculous, but you'll probably never be the incredibly creative person you aspire to be. You have to be open to let more in. When you're open, you're vulnerable. Think of it as the physics of creativity. Being open makes you vulnerable. Being vulnerable increases your ability to see. Increasing your ability to see multiplies your options. Multiplying your options enables you to be more selective. Being more selective allows you to notice ways to make new connections. New connections can be used to create something new. Creating something new involves putting things, thoughts, ingredients, components, or whatever, together in a new way. The design or plan for how you will ultimately decide to put things together will be based on the new meaning you create using the new connections you discovered. And this new meaning must satisfy your creative pursuit's needs and fulfill each objective in a readily recognizable way. If you want to create something dazzling and unforgettable, your audience has to get it, to understand it. It has to make sense to them in a relatable way. They have to recognize and comprehend what you have created, or it will fall flat. Being willing to look ridiculous can improve your ability to see exponentially, because you can see more when you stop worrying about failing or looking stupid. And it occurs to me immediately when we think about writing with this looking ridiculous, that often the reason people can see themselves in what someone writes is because the other person has actually, the author, has put themselves in there.
Yeah.
In order to do that, they have to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that includes looking ridiculous. Even if it's in a room with no one else around and it's just you, you can't protect yourself from looking ridiculous to yourself, or you don't get to the juice.
So how did this play out in the classroom?
People started to do it. The students started to open up. They started to talk about stuff they'd never talked about to anybody. They talked to each other. They were kind to each other. They made space for each other. It was pretty phenomenal, almost all the time. And every once in a while, there would be one person who resisted with all of their might the entire time because it was just too much for them. And I would warn them at the beginning of the semester what was going to happen and tell them if they felt that this was a process they wouldn't enjoy, they should probably leave now. And no one ever left. But it was very remarkable the way that they ended up supporting each other, because they stopped judging each other. They started encouraging each other to be more vulnerable, to say more, to show more. And then everybody would zing, 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 zing off of everything everybody else did.
Yeah, you know, I'm just in this moment having this thought about meditation and how it's essentially the same thing. It's just the idea of being open to whatever crosses your mind and sitting with it, even if it's uncomfortable or feels like a waste of time, or, you know, it's like you were saying about sitting in your living room and looking at the pillow you bought and thinking, how did that get there? Why did I choose something so ugly? That process happens in your mind, even if you are practicing Zen and staring at the wall.
Right.
You know, it's
absolutely
essentially the same thing.
Absolutely. And in the process where you're looking at the pillow, you also begin to say to yourself, so why do I think it's ugly?
Right.
And how would it not be ugly?
Right.
And what do I want to do about the fact that it's ugly?
Yeah, or you might think about when you bought it, who you were with,
right,
what mood you were in.
Did I want that pillow to begin with?
Yeah, right.
I think I did. What does that mean? Oh, I changed. That's
right.
Okay.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So does that pillow represent my whole artistic integrity?
Right.
No. It just goes on and on and on. So It's so interesting to me that you said meditation, because it's so many people, when they try to meditate, when they meditate, either one, they get that busy, busy brain, yeah, and they feel like failures.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that's your brain. That's what's happening right now.
Right.
That's okay too. And letting that all come through. If I'm doing that to create something, then I want to see what sticks.
Right.
I want to notice what I want to use.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's just all in the way that we see things when,
yes,
we look at the ground.
Absolutely.
Or if it's for writers, it's in what is going on in your mind when you're staring at a blank screen, right? All the things that you feel like you are supposed to be writing about often don't come. And that's when you find yourself staring across the room at the couch and looking at the pillow because you're procrastinating, or you feel like you're procrastinating from what you're supposed to be doing. That focus again that we talk
right,
about.
Yeah.
So like, how do you get a balance between focus so that you can actually be in a creative space and make something and play?
So let's go back to There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly. So in that example, there is a structure. There is a goal. But there's also permission to be ridiculous at the same time.
Yeah.
So if I was standing in front of a blank wall instead of a blank computer screen, and somebody gave me a Sharpie or some other permanent marker and told me to begin to write on the wall, and I also thought maybe I had permission to write on the wall, but maybe not. If I started to write on the wall with the permanent marker, unless there was a can of paint that I could paint over it when I was done, I would feel paralyzed because anything I put on the wall would be there.
Yeah.
And if I fixed it, I'd have to cross it out. And I'm also worrying about it sticking around and not being right. And oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
This is why I can't decorate my house. Okay. This is why the paint that was on the walls when we bought the house that I hated 5 years ago is still on the walls. That's
so
why.
I hear you. But I think that those choices we have in life, whether it's the choice of which word to use or the choice of what paint to use or whatever it is, we are judging the choice as a failure or a success.
Before you even make the choice.
Before you make the choice.
Yeah.
And the failure or the success is the ability to begin, to continue, to assess, and then repeat. Right?
Yeah.
So I begin. I'm jumping in. I'm beginning. Whatever that looks like for me with my creative process. My jumping in may be very slow and careful. It isn't actually. Mine is jump in. It's almost a cannonball, right?
Yeah, but you're not slow.
Anything in between is all good. That's the begin, right? Then continue. If it doesn't feel like it's working, well, what am I writing about right now? I'm writing about loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm writing about loneliness, and maybe I'm writing a short story or a novel and somebody feels lonely. So I'm going to get in touch with writing about loneliness.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm not writing about how the character feels lonely right now. I'm just writing about loneliness because that's what I need to do right now.
Yeah.
I need to write about loneliness. And if I have to write about the character's loneliness with exactly the right words, I'm already failing because I'm not allowing myself to create that, to bring it up, to notice how do I feel when I'm lonely? Have I seen other people who are lonely? And oh, you're getting off track. It's about this
and
character. And but no, it's I continue. Then I look at it. Well, that looks like the ugly couch pillow, but that looks good.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you're reminding me of writing my thesis in graduate school. Because so many times the advice when we got stuck was open up a whole nother file on your computer or get another notebook or whatever that the mentor will never see and put all that stuff in there and then go and choose from that stuff for your magnum opus, with a paint dropper or whatever.
So you're reminding me, I had a friend and a colleague who got stuck writing his dissertation. He was writing about different people through history who had done a certain thing. I'm not going to say more than that because I don't want to out the gentleman, but he got stuck. He had all these great ideas. He had lots of notes, lots of research. And when he went to write, he had he just got stuck as if he was coming up against a rubber wall that he bounced right off of every time. But this person was also someone who had done one-man shows and had done a lot of performance in his life. And I said, he came to me and said, can you help me with this? And I think he may have asked many other people before he asked me even. And, you know, creativity, maybe she can help me. And I said, you know what? Forget about the dissertation. Take one of those people and do a stand-up routine about it. Talk about the person as if you are the person. Present a one-person show talking about embracing. Become that character.
How cool.
Make it funny. Crawl into it. Do the things that you do your way. And literally stop thinking about your dissertation.
Yeah.
He did that with about six of the people. And he very intelligently invited people who were in different fields that had to do with what he was writing about to give feedback. But it was a performance for fun's sake, but it organized everything in his brain in a different way.
That's so cool.
And then he sat down and he wrote and it was all there.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah, because he gave himself permission to not have it need to be perfect.
Right.
He gave himself permission to see.
Right.
But in order to do that, he had to keep doing. Right. So you see, but then you continue to do, and then you see, and it just keeps going.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what makes the excellence, what makes it work, is when you see what you decide to keep, what you decide to get rid of, to put together.
Yeah. So I'm glad you said that, because I want to talk about the part in the book that is, it's not quite the end, but it's, you're kind of wrapping up and you're talking about, how do you know when you're done?
Oh, yeah.
Talk to me about how you know when you're done.
Oh, so sometimes you're done because you're done. You know,
because you're tired of the project.
You're just tired. I'm finished. That was enough. We can go now. We were going to go sightseeing all day, but you know, I'm done. I'm just done. My feet are tired. Cobblestones, I did not realize the kind of shoes I needed to wear.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. You're just done. Sometimes you're done because you think you're done because you did something.
Right.
I'm so grateful I found something that seems to work. It's satisfactory. This is great. I'm done.
Yeah.
Because you're back to that, I just need to finish it.
Right, right.
I'm not creating. I'm not building. I'm not constructing. I'm finishing. You're finishing from the get-go.
Ticking boxes.
Yeah. I begin to finish when I start. No, you don't. You begin to create when you start.
Right.
Then you finish. And how do you finish? Well, when you go to finishing school in the old days, I don't know if anybody still does that, it was to put the polish on.
Yeah.
Right? So in one of the other chapters about talking and working in a creative group, I talk about people who are polishers, who finish things. Well, they don't just make it shiny. They don't just make sure that the mechanics are correct. They make sure it satisfies what's needed for the project. But that's what you do after you get to the place where it's the way you want it to be,
right,
the way it needs to be for your project. And how do you know when you're there? When it feels right, and the only thing that would make you continue is the fear that it will be judged. And that's when you start to overfinish.
Mm-hmm.
You start to tweak and pull until this beautiful thing you created either becomes everyday and ordinary,
yeah,
or it has so much parsley and ribbon on it that you can't find the substance of what you started to say to begin with.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's why we have like postpartum depression when we finish big projects.
Well, there's a lot of energy that comes from creation,
yeah,
right? When you, at a book launch the other day, when I came home, I stayed up till 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
I binged movies and I read because I had so much energy.
Yeah.
And yet I was exhausted.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Right.
It is a super, super closed energy system of give it out to the world, the audience, whether they're sitting in front of you or they're imaginary because they're not going to exist until they encounter your work somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
You're giving them all this energy and you're getting so much energy by what you're creating to offer to them at the same time.
Yeah.
So when we're done, sometimes after the relief and after the celebration, what we don't realize is we have a sense of loss.
Yeah.
And for some of us, that sense of loss is just, okay, deck's clear, we can do the next thing.
Right.
Cool.
I'm like, what am I going to do now?
Yeah. And other people that, so in the book, we'll talk about initiators and developers. God, is this true for writing, right?
Yeah.
There are so many people who are really good at coming up with ideas. Another skill is to take that idea and develop it.
Yeah.
So most of us are better at one of those things than the other.
Yeah.
And then we have to figure out ways, tricks, and things we can do to help us do the one better that we feel we're not as good at. Sometimes we are, it just scares us more.
You mean people who are good developers or good polishers to try to be people with vision?
You know, people who are good initiators,
yeah,
or developers. So people who want to come up with a good idea and feel like, oh, I have a good idea once every 127 years.
Yeah.
You know? And then other people are like, do you need an idea? Okay, I'll give you 72. Just sit for 3 seconds.
Right.
Here they all are. And then somebody else says, oh my God, I know exactly what I want to create, write, whatever. And now I don't know how to make it bigger. I don't know how to make it matter.
Yeah.
I don't know how to connect it to the next thing. Or I wrote this and I wrote that, but now what? Because it's development and it's the transition and it's the knitting and all of those things. And maybe they secretly even are good at it, but they've been told they're not good at it, or somewhere along the line they learned that that's the hard part about what you do.
Right.
And so now it's hard. It's difficult. And that's the story they're telling themselves about that.
Right.
So how do you find ways to help yourself do what works for you in that situation?
Okay. Yeah.
So for example, being an initiator, if you're someone who doesn't really come up with a lot of ideas, that when you get an idea, you get so excited you can hardly stand it because you didn't have one previously.
Yeah, I think I'm in that camp.
Okay, so the seeing helps with that.
Yeah.
Because if you see more, suddenly there are ideas crawling all over the
place.
That's
why that part of the book really resonated with me, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, it's exciting. And then if you watch somebody else, if you introduce what you see to someone else, just in conversation, then you get to see how they see what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly what you're seeing then gets even bigger.
Right.
And it just keeps going.
Right.
So there are so many ways. Also, that wonderful thing happens. If you were going to buy a Volkswagen Beetle when they were available in a certain way, once you made that decision, you would start to see them everywhere.
Yeah.
If you are hoping or dreading the possibility that you're pregnant, pregnant women will begin to surround you everywhere. It's just something that happens, that synchronicity of life. So once you notice something or have an idea, even the act of seeing it in other places helps you. For some people, that's scary. Well, does that mean my idea is not exciting or important? Because it's over here, too. Yeah, it's over there, but somebody has a totally different take on it.
Yeah.
This is yours.
Yeah. And you can have a conversation with those people.
Yes. Yes. Or maybe you're someone for your process.
Yeah.
You can't have a conversation with them.
Yeah.
Because you get your head turned too quickly and you want to do your own thing first and maybe then have the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a big part of honoring what works for you. Again, you have to be vulnerable to figure that out because that means you have to make mistakes and see what doesn't work for you. And then give yourself permission to be of enough value that you can do it your way.
Yeah.
And that your way is even, your method has value.
Right.
But it does because it works for you.
Right. Right. I feel like I'm developing some of those skills now at in my early 50s.
Yes.
I was so far away from them when I was a college student that I wish I had been able to take your class.
To that end, to tell you that a lot of my students get back in touch with me and they'll say to me, oh my God, I use the pencil exercise all the time. Yeah. Oh my God, I do this all the time. They took it and ran with it. I made an offering to them.
Yeah.
But they stepped up. They were vulnerable. And then they went, wow, if I could use that for this, I could use that method for that.
Yeah.
And they took it everywhere in their lives.
And they have agency.
Right, they do. And they also learned to be a little more vulnerable in general. And they learned to value their own process and to believe that their ideas have worth, which I think are the biggest stumbling blocks for all of us when we're trying to do something. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, this is amazing. This is incredible. I'm doing so well. I love what I'm writing. Is that really any good?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. What was the pencil exercise?
The pencil exercise was I held a pencil up. It happened to be sharpened. When I was, when I remembered all of my, props, I would have one sharpened, an old-fashioned pencil with an eraser that you sharpen, and one that wasn't sharpened. And I would ask my students, what can you do with a pencil? And in front of the classroom was a giant whiteboard, and I would ask two students to write, to try to capture everything we said. Don't worry if they duplicated each other, but make sure they didn't miss anything. Don't worry about spelling. Just make sure we could read what they wrote. And the students would start out with the normal things. You can write with it. You can draw with it, blah, 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 blah. And they would continue. And maybe they'd come up with 30 things. It was at the very beginning of the semester, so people were pretty hesitant to come up with things. And these were very creative people, mm-hmm. but they were hesitant. And then once we were done, I'd say, okay, is that it? Yeah, maybe a couple other little things. But then we would begin to sort the things that you do with a pencil. So you can stab something, stab it in. So one of the things they would come up with was, say, somebody would say you could use it as chopsticks. And somebody else would say, yeah, you could just stab it into a piece of food to eat it. Mm-hmm. I'd say, great. So the stabbing motion, what else can you do by stabbing a pencil? And then we'd go crazy. You could put a whole bunch of them in a line and stab them into the ground and make a border for your flower bed, right? You could then roast a marshmallow on it because you're stabbing the marshmallow. Mm-hmm. You keep going, what if I tap it? What if I roll it? What if I throw it? And suddenly all these ideas would come to them. Then we would say categories. Well, if I'm using it for cooking or eating, how else could I use it that way? If I'm using it as a musical instrument or if I'm making art with it, and suddenly everything opens up.
Right.
So categorizing, labeling what you come up with, and then jumping off to another idea from that. So if you were trying to come up with ideas for writing, for right. example.
Or a prompt for yes. listeners of this show.
Yes, you could do exactly the same thing, right?
Is there anything, any last words that you want our listeners to take away from the from this interview?
I think, to me, the idea that everybody has something that they can offer the world that's unique is really important. And that's the most vulnerable thing of all, to believe that that's true and to hold on to that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview that guest host Kim McQueen conducted with Vermont author Cince Bonino. You can learn more about Cince's work at cchoosedo.com. This week's Write the Book prompt comes from Cince Bonino's new book, One Key See, One Key Do, and it's about noticing things we usually miss. pick something at random to notice. You could choose to intentionally pay attention to all the doorknobs and handles you encounter today, or perhaps notice all the buttons on people's clothing. Take the time to notice something you don't usually focus your attention on. For instance, you could notice if the people around you, not just the ones you know, are right or left-handed. Notice all the slip-on shoes. Notice all the height differences in the couples and small groups of people you encounter. Notice the things people do when other people are speaking. Most of all, notice what you think and do as you attempt to see more. Figure out what you do intuitively that helps you notice more. Make a note so that you can do it on purpose in the future. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. That's where you'll find information about my book giveaway. You can look for that labeled tab on the top of my homepage. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.